Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. This is the last talk of this year's Rains Retreat. This year's Wasa Wasa. And of course, everyone will probably agree that the Rains Retreat just goes so fast. And we come to what's called another ending. And this life is full of endings, but they're never perfect endings. Because the endings of most people are just new beginnings. It's not as if we're finishing work, but we've got some more work to do afterwards. And so the burden of life, the burden of doing, continues. For some. Because sometimes you should ask yourself, but when is all this coming and going going to be completed? When is all the doing going to be finished? When can there be a rest? Using a metaphor, the simile of going on a journey. When is all the walking and journeying going to be finished? And when can one just go to the home in the evening to put one's feet up and just relax? When all the jobs are done, when all the burdens have been carried, when you can say that what had to be done has been done. There is no more samsara for me. That should be the goal of one's life. Whether monastic life, lay life, to get this thing which we have to do finished. And to get that job finished, we have been practicing for these last 3 months. And sometimes you may have finished off some of the jobs. Sometimes if you haven't been practicing carefully, you're just creating more jobs for yourself in the future. I'm not talking about jobs in building or in the office or in the kitchen. I'm talking about the jobs of the defilements, the jobs of craving, the jobs of building the sense of self inside more and more strong. Because the crux of this practice, the core teaching around which the path which leads out of samsara revolves, is the understanding of non-self. As long as there's a sense of me and mine there, there'll always be arguments, defensiveness. There'll always be holding on to one's ideas and views. There'll always be the wanting. When you investigate anatta, you can see that sometimes the best way to investigate and understand this crucial teaching of Buddhism is to think or to investigate not so much what this self is, but what the self does. What is a function of an ego, of a self? What is a function of a me? When you investigate in that way, you can see that the function of the atta, the function of a self, is to do, to own, to control. And that doing, controlling, owning is our problem. It's the source of suffering. Well, the controlling which we try and do in this monastery, trying to control that your little area, what you feel secure, all of that is coming from an illusion of self. And thinking you own anything. I've said very often that when you look at these five khandhas, you can see it's the ownership of them which causes the problem. We think we own this body, when in truth it belongs to nature. It belongs to nature because the natural causes determine whether I'm healthy or whether I'm sick. Not whether what I do. Not whether I choose to take the medicine or not to take the medicine, to exercise or to not to exercise. Sometimes if the medicine was that good, all we need to do is to get the right medicine, we'd all be healthy, but you all know that never works. Sometimes you can take boxes and boxes of medicine and just get more sick. Sometimes these things don't work. This body doesn't belong to us, it belongs to nature. The feeling, the Vedana, doesn't belong to us, it belongs to nature. The perceptions, they don't belong to us. Thoughts and emotions inside, even the will, it does not belong to us. And consciousness is which knows, that doesn't belong to us either. Seeing that these things don't belong to us, we want to ask, who do they belong to then? You can just answer, they just belong to nature, because they follow natural causes and results. It's when we think we own these things, or these things belong to us, that's where suffering arises, that's where craving comes from. Remember that craving is the nexus, the joining between the illusion and the world which we observe and experience. When there's an illusion of self inside, it will always grasp that world as if it's mine, and I own this, and I have something to do with this. If that illusion is seen through deeply, and you realize that all of this which you're experiencing doesn't belong to anyone, it's this empty process which is just going on and on and on. Once the illusion is seen through, the core is seen as being empty, the realization will come that it's because of that illusion, this empty process of the five khandhas has been going on for so long. Once that illusion is seen through, you know that there is going to be an end to the rains retreat. There is going to be an end to samsara. There is going to be an end to dukkha. But only when you see that. So it's important, as people who are interested in finding the truth, is actually to try and see, what are you still holding on to? What do you still take to be me, take to be mine? What do you think you own? It's easy to find out the answer to that question, because what you think you own is what you're attached to, what you can't give up, what you can't let go of. That's why the practice of meditation we've been doing for the last almost 3 months is not just training to let go just for the sake of letting go. It's to see how much we can let go and to see what's stopping us. To see what obstacles we come up against. Because every obstacle you come up against in your meditation is teaching you there's an illusion of self living somewhere around that area. There is an attachment there. There is an unwillingness to go further. Why? What are you afraid to lose? You see, so much of our life is controlling. We try and control our families to try and make everyone happy. We can't do that. We try and control our bodies to make it healthy. We can't do that. We try and control our situation around us so everyone just does what we want them to do. We just can't do that. We try and control our thoughts. We can't do that. All this controlling never works, just gives us more problems. It takes a great leap of courage to be able to let go of that. That controlling, you can see just how it manifests in the old thinking of the past and the future, trying to learn the mistakes from the past. Why didn't it work last time? The future, this time it's going to work. When he says that, this is what I'm going to come back at him with. Next time I come to the range retreat here, this is what I'm going to do. The next place I'm going to go to, this is how I'm going to practice. That going off into the future, can you see that as all controlling? Coming from the doer, the sense of self inside. That's why the person who has seen through that will control less and less and less. and we'll let just nature flow, just influencing it very gently, very lightly. The very fact that Buddhism has been known as a gentle religion, which has treated the world very lightly over 25 centuries, is because it's seen through the illusion of self. Because it does not want to control. It sees that controlling as just craving and attachment. Nothing to do with the right way. Nothing to do with the Dhamma. And so one sees that in one's own mind. And all the problems and difficulties, if one wants to treat one's life gently, less and less control, less and less doing. And so the practice of meditation has been unearthing these truths. It's been learning how to come across the hurdles to meditation and understand why it's a hurdle. And to see if one can see it in terms of non-self. If you come across anything like going off into the past and future, it's all coming from your illusion of me. Some of you think that you're leaving after the range retreat. You're not leaving. You weren't here anyway. What can leave? You think you go somewhere else? But it feels the same, it's still the same sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, mind. Nothing really changes. The illusion, well, as long as the illusion is there. So when we see it this way, that the past and the future, we can see it just a dream made of the illusion of controlling, coming from the sense of self. And all the thinking as well. Why think? So often because we feel secure, if we think things out and plan things out, they're going to go our way. Again, all controlling. All coming from the doer, the illusion of self. It's marvelous. It's wonderful to trust yourself to nature. It's like when you go in an aeroplane, going overseas. And just trust the pilot knows what to do. You can sit back and absolutely relax. I often say when I'm on a plane, I don't have to give a talk. You know, can't do any building. Can't answer any phone calls. Can't give any interviews. Just sit there and do nothing. It's bliss. Just allow nature to take me wherever it's going to take me. It's how you meditate. Like getting on an aeroplane. Once you board, the present moment awareness, silence, get up board onto the breath. Once you're on the breath, you just let go and enjoy the journey. So there's no controlling, no doing. Who owns the breath anyway? The breath is also just part of nature. Breath comes in, breath comes out, according to the body. So often that at that stage of any meditation, it gets uncomfortable whenever you try and control. Whenever you try and make it smooth, or you try and make it long, or you try and make it this way or that way. Whenever that problem arises in my meditation, the breath is uncomfortable, I just leave it alone. I'm not concerned. Breath, you do your breathing. I'm just watching. It's not my problem. Somebody else's problem. And by saying that, by having that attitude, very soon the breath calms down. So I know the reason why it's unpleasant and uncomfortable is because I am interfering with it. The controller, the doer. That's why it's lovely to be able to know just even that simple piece of wisdom. And to investigate it with wisdom. Why is it that comfort comes from letting go? Why is it that peace comes from just allowing nature just to run its course? Why is it that bliss comes the longer you leave things alone? Why is it that things start to quiet and become so peaceful and so still the less you do? What it's teaching you is this illusion of self. It's taking this to be mine is what causes suffering. It causes dukkha. There's a heart of dukkha. Not getting what you want, getting what you don't want. Either way, just wanting is a problem. Even getting what you want is dukkha. It just reinforces the illusion you're going to get what you want next time. How often have you got what you wanted? And how often have you got what you don't want? This life is just getting what you don't want, sooner or later. And in the end, everyone gets what they don't want. They all die. Except those people who want to die. They commit suicide and they usually get rescued and saved and they get what they don't want. Whatever, anyway. But so often is the case that all that wanting is the cause of suffering. And you can see this in the meditation. This is why this meditation we've been doing, which I encourage, which I teach in this monastery, should never be called samatha, nor should be called vipassana, it's bhavana. It includes both aspects of the path. The more you quieten the mind, the more you come across the deeper and deeper levels of illusion of self. You think the self controls the past and future, you think the self is that which thinks. That's why we worship thinking, because it's my thoughts. And my thoughts are important. And my thoughts are right, your thoughts are wrong. Probably you're already getting some thoughts, your thoughts, challenging my thoughts. And whose thoughts are wrong? I'll tell you whose thoughts are wrong. Both thoughts are wrong. All these thoughts are wrong. Shut up. Be quiet. Leave them alone. There's so much noise. Just thoughts are like the sounds of the crows. Gah, gah, gah. They just disturb the meditation. Some years ago there was a monk who was actually staying next to me in the terrace hut. And he came and, I'm not sure where he got, I think he found in the workshop all this foam and he put it around the doors. And he sort of asked me to be very quiet because he was doing a lot of meditation, not to slam the doors. So I was very quiet. I was very, very quiet. But then he started complaining about the frogs and the crows. He should have been complaining about the frogs and the crows in his mind, the ga, 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 the thoughts. That's the problem. Because when we worship those thoughts, when we think they're my thoughts, they come from a sense of self, we'll never be able to let them go. They never stop. That's why anatta sanya, not me, not mine, not a self, these thoughts, not me, not mine, not a self. They're just like the wind. Who knows where it comes from? It's nature. One moment it's blowing, next moment it's stopped. We only know it when it comes past us. But we don't own that wind. We can't grab it and catch it and put it in a box. In the same way of thinking, we try and grab it and put it in a box, but we can't. If you notice thought very carefully, it flows so quickly through our minds. We can't really catch it. It's just like the wind, rustling the leaves of our consciousness. Just making little sounds, that's all. And out of those little sounds of the leaves rustling, through prapancha we manufacture songs, give it meaning. But it's all just rustle, that's all. The rustling of our mind. It has no real meaning. When we can develop anatta sanya, these thoughts, not me, not mine, not a self, then you find you can let go of these things. The only reason they become a problem is because of our identification with them. If they weren't your thoughts, good thoughts, bad thoughts, angry thoughts, lustful thoughts, why worry about them? Why be concerned about them? And some monks, good monks, think, well, if I'm not worried about lustful thoughts, if I don't try and get rid of them, they'll just keep going on and on and on, and soon I'll have to disrobe. If you truly let go, if you truly take away the sense of self, lustful thoughts, angry thoughts, they soon disappear. They haven't got a place to roost on. They haven't got a place to build up energy. It's like a spark, but with no fuel to light. It's like a match, but everything around is wet and damp, and it can't start a fire. If you have that anatasanya, a thought of lust or a thought of anger, cannot start a fire in the mind. It just goes out almost immediately. So have that confidence in the Lord Buddha's teaching of non-self. All of these thoughts aren't mine. If those thoughts of anger and lust or jealousy or fear or righteous indignation or whatever else comes up, and if they last a long time, if they can establish themselves in the mind, that's a sure sign that you've lost the anatasanya and you've got a sense of self there. You've got a sense of me. They've insulted me. They've hurt me. Or whatever else is the reason. It's my thoughts. So just letting go of that sense of self, you'll see the thoughts will disappear and you get to a sense of silence. Very often people make the mistakes in their meditation of having the self drive meditation. So you want to be the silence. You want to get rid of the talking. And it never works that way. Because it's coming from a sense of self. It's more doing, not letting go. When you manage to find the correct switch, the correct button, you press that non-self button, things stop by themselves. It's a letting go. It's a letting go of doing, because that's what the self does. The self always wants to get involved and mess things up and stir things around. The non-self just stands back. Just watches and leaves it alone. And each one of you have had times during this meditation retreat when you've pressed that non-self button, when you've let go. You've just stood back in your meditation and just present moment and future, sorry, past and future have disappeared. Thoughts have slowed down, maybe even stopped. And just the breath is there. The breath, nice and clear, nice and easy. It's the most easiest thing in the world to do, as long as you're not there. And this gives you the insights into this path, into this practice. Look, you've got that far, and that's beautiful. Just to get the easy, effortless awareness of the breath. Why? Because you've given up so much. You've given up the sense of self with all that it thinks it owns. You go deeper with this anatasanya. You can even give up the breath. Giving up the breath is very difficult for a person. They think that this breath is so important. This is life. If we don't breathe, we think we die. That's why breath meditation is extremely powerful, but also very difficult. To give up control of the breath is like giving up control of life. Or rather, giving up control of your body. Letting go of the body is the way into jhanas, the way into the bliss states. Why is it that people have such a hard time getting into those jhana states? The reason is because there must be some sense of self there who thinks it owns this body. Who thinks it is this body? In a very deep and powerful sense, we haven't yet untied this knot to our bodies. That's why that we keep going from place to place in the world. It's all changing the material things outside, not changing what's inside. So we always keep changing our bodies from lifetime to lifetime, changing where we live, changing where we practice. But really we're not changing very much at all, not the important stuff. It's still attachment to the body and the world outside. Still caught up with his five senses. However, so this beautiful path of samadhi which the Buddha taught, the deeper you get in your meditation, the more happiness and bliss you get. That happiness and bliss in meditation is like the bribe. The bribe which encourages you just to let go that little bit more. To let go of a little bit more of the sense of self and to see what you can do. And as you let go of the sense of self more and more, this is not my breath, this is not my body. The body disappears. When the body disappears, it gives you a great sense of happiness. Kaya prasadi. The tranquility of the body. So this body with all its irritations and heaviness and aches and pains and sickness can actually disappear. Oh, what bliss to let go of this body. Once you let go of this body and you're in the mind, it doesn't matter where you are in the world, because the world has disappeared as well. Whether you're in Thailand or whether you're in England or New Zealand or Australia or on the moon, it doesn't matter. You let go of that world. It's so wonderful to let go of that world. Even a monastery like Bodhinyana Monastery, it just takes up so much effort to keep going. The kitchen takes up so much work just to feed these bodies. Isn't it wonderful if we can just let go of all this? And this is how you let go of it. You don't let go of this body by getting on a bus or an aeroplane and going somewhere else. You take this body with you. You let go of this body in deep meditation. And one of the problems of letting go is the attachment. That's why I've caught myself sometimes getting very peaceful. And then sort of, how are my feet doing? As if you can't let the body go. Or you hear a sound outside, what's that? You can't let the world outside go. This is all a sign that the sense of self is still strong in there. So let it go. Let go of that identification, attachment to the body. Give the body to nature. Trust nature to look after it while you do your meditation. This body is not me. The sight is not me. I don't own the visions. I don't own the sounds, it's nothing to do with me. Someone else is speaking, it's their problem. It's the crows or the kookaburras. I don't need to listen to them. I don't need to smell or taste. I don't even need to feel this body. The body can look after itself. I'm letting go. Not interested, not concerned. So move away from that body. The great journey, the one which is really worth taking, the real place to leave, is this body. Leave this body, go somewhere else. This body is the problem. Once you can see that the reason you can't let go of the body is some sort of attachment, identification, that's as I was saying last week, you should do a lot of body contemplation. Kayagata sati. Or Kayanupasana. If you do that reflection on the body again and again and again, you're weakening this attachment. Reflect on death, the death of this body. Of old age and sickness. This is what this body is all about. Don't celebrate this body. Don't think it's yours. Once you can do this and the body disappears, and you let go of that attachment, you get more and more happiness. And then sometimes people think that the mind is theirs. Still doing things. Still controlling. Controlling the breath. Controlling the beautiful breath. Or even controlling the nimitta. Powerful things happen when you start to go on the the track of letting go of the sense of self. As you go into this meditation more and more, you can just use that as a mantra. Not coming from you, but just coming from conditioning. Not me, not mine, not a self. It's not me, not mine, not a self. The breath, not me, not mine, not a self. The beautiful breath, not me, not mine, not a self, doesn't belong to me. Nimitta comes up, this is not mine either. I haven't attained a nimitta, just a nimitta has come, that's all. Take away the identification, ownership, and then nimittas come up very easily. They come up very beautifully and very bright. If you try and own that nimitta, if you try and capture it as yours, you're asking for problems and difficulties. It will disappear. It does not want to be captured. It's like a bird who's afraid of human beings. And if that human being tries to capture it, it will never come close again. Just sit still and just allow the bird of the nimitta just to come and play. It's not mine, it's just nature, that's all. And if you're lucky, that bird will lay on your head. The nimitta will come closer and will just absorb you into itself. And that's when you really start to understand about anatta. Because there you've let go of so much doing. There's hardly any doing left at all. But those who are very skillful and have lots of experience of first jhana will see a very slight remnant of doing. That's the vitakka vichara. Still, there is a sense of control, almost like the last echo, like a dead man twitching. The twitch of the mind going towards the object, which is vitakka, and holding on to it stupidly, as if it would go. But because of that holding on to it, that disturbs the concentration. That holding on is called vichara. And that disturbance is enough to make the mind separate from the object. But not very long. The bliss, the beauty is so great, almost immediately pulling you back again. That's the vitakka. This wobble of the mind, which you can see after you've had these experiences. Still some doing. Still a lack of confidence. Still a lack of letting go of the sense of self in its doing mode. But there comes a time when you have so much confidence in this whole direction of letting go of the sense of self. So much confidence in the teaching of anatta. The mind even lets go of that last wobble. The sign of letting go is stillness. The sign of the full letting go of the doer is absolute stillness. That absolute stillness is called samadhi, sustained attention. That's why that when one enters that second jhana, there is no more doing. The mind is absolutely still. There's not even a wobble. It's full samadhi. And the object of the mind is just the piti sukha born of that samadhi. No more moving. No more coming and going. That is where the first stopping and ending can be experienced in terms of coming and going. How often it is the mind comes and goes. Always something else arising in the mind. It's as if we're on a perpetual journey, never having any rest whatsoever. If that was with your body, always coming and going, never resting, never being able even to sleep, just how much suffering that would be. How much more suffering is it when the mind can never stop? When there's always a moving, a doing. in that second jhana, this stopping. And the strange thing is, for those who experience that state in its fullness, is it's strange and it's weird and something which you can't even imagine. Because the mind has actually stopped and you're still. I mean, really still, not what most people think is stillness. Well, there's one perception in the mind for a long period of time which doesn't move or alter or change in any which way. Just a singleness of perception with no wobbles or change. Weird, strange, but there, that's a good description. And there, you've noticed the doer has gone. This idea of self which promises happiness, that I will make you happy, says the illusion of self. I will get you whatever you want, says the illusion of self. I will look after you. Trust me, says the illusion of self. Go here, go there, think this, eat that. You never get happy that way. Been doing that for many years. The illusion has been leading you by the nose all over the world. All over samsara. There's no end that way. The end of doing comes in the second jhana. When that end of doing is there, you can see very clearly that why on earth did I ever think that this was important? Doing, controlling, making. And when you let go that much, a huge burden disappears. Burden of responsibility. All responsibility. Responsibility is doing. And feeling guilty when what one does goes wrong. Feeling proud and good when it goes right. Success and failure, two of the, what the Buddha called the loka dhammas. Praise and blame, the other two of the loka dhammas. Fame and lack of fame. These are all loka dhammas, together with sukha and dukkha. Those loka dhammas, they're out of your control. Even if you think you are smart, even if you think you are clever and knowledgeable, you still stuff up from time to time. With all of your doing, how much happiness has it ever given you? With all of your coming and going, where's it ever got you? Surely there must be an end somewhere. This is where one feels that end. And after one's felt that end, not only does one understand a very huge portion of anatta, one understands that anatta and the end of suffering go together. The more you let go of an illusion of self, the more bliss you feel. Deep bliss, profound bliss. Bliss which is full of wisdom. Because that is teaching you. The last thing you have to overcome in the illusion of self, after getting rid of the body and getting rid of the doer. The doer, so I should say a bit more, this is where you find out what will is. No chedana. I love confusing people with this idea of will, saying that you've got no choice but to be here. There is no such thing as free will. Who decided to say this anyway? Was it me or somebody else or what? Because when you achieve some of these states and you look at this thing we call doing or will, which originates from the illusion of self, or at least the illusion that I am the one who wills, when you actually see what chetana really is, fully conditioned, it shocks you at first. It's very uncomfortable at first because you always think that you are in control, as if free will is one of your inalienable rights, the right to choose. And when you look very deeply, you have got no right to choose at all. It's profoundly challenging. Sometimes you ask yourself, why do you become a monk? Why did you become an abbot of a monastery? Just basically, I had no choice. I had no choice. Me. There was no me inside to push those buttons. It makes it much easier. No success, no failure. No praise, no blame. Just conditions rolling on. Empty conditions. But this is only something you can, I like saying this because it challenges people. I don't expect people to agree with me, let alone understand what I'm saying. I'd say this to challenge, to weaken the assumptions, and to open the possibility for the jhana states where there's no one there to call the shots. And there you will understand what chaitanya, what will is. But deeper than that, there's a sense of the one who knows, which even sometimes great meditation teachers have taken to be a self. And great yogis, Hindu yogis, have taken that to be a self. That to be God, the knowing. And certainly in those jhanas, the sense of knowing is so blissful and so powerful and so pervasive. It's very easy to understand why some people can say that's omniscience. It's all-encompassing in a profound sense. Not in the sense of knowing what's going on here in the world or there in the world, but all-knowing in that moment. And that powerful sense of knowing can only be truly seen as non-self by going in the deeper and deeper and deeper through those jhanas. Because that's not you. The Buddha was very wonderful and powerful when he taught that not just sight, sound, smell, taste, touch is not self, but even the mind is not self. Not just the four khandhas, anicca, dukkha, anatta, but also the fifth khanda, consciousness, is also anicca, dukkha, anatta. A powerful teaching. And I'm sure that those disciples in the time of the Buddha, they may have understood the first four khandhas, but when the Buddha came to the fifth khanda and said that was anatta as well, that would have been very powerful. That would have been the hammer which would have probably destroyed the last of the defilements. Because so often we think that I am the one listening to this. I am the one feeling the pain in the body. I am the one experiencing the happiness and joy. That I am the one who knows. You cannot think your way past that. That is the hurdle, a big brick wall. The only way that that illusion can be overcome is by seeing consciousness itself start to disappear. How can you see consciousness disappear when it's always here? And the only time you can know you're conscious is when you're conscious. This is what happens when you get into these beautiful, blissful jhana states. The consciousness also starts to disappear, stage by stage, slice by slice, as bits of consciousness fall away. In the third jhana, the consciousness of pity, or that part of consciousness which is pity, falls away. In the fourth jhana, that part of consciousness which is sukha falls away. In the immaterial jhanas, more and more parts of consciousness falls away. In neva sanya, na sanya, neither perception nor non-perception. Just almost the last, only the last part of consciousness is left. Most of it is already gone. I like to call those arupa states, instead of infinite space, like unbounded, unlimited, undelineated space. Space without a label, without a concept to define it, without a boundary. That's instead of infinite, that word has got just too overused. The word actually infinite in mathematics is a very powerful word, and sort of it's very hard to actually understand what infinity is. But it's sort of boundless, without limits, without designations, without names, just unable to be put in a box. Anything like that sort of starts to give you the meaning of these states. Like unbounded consciousness in the second jhana, in the second avupa. Is that right? Yeah, something like that. And just nothing at all. See how just the limits, the boundaries, thingness is being given away. The thingness of consciousness itself is being abandoned, fading away, disappearing, going, getting to cessation. And whether you go all the way into cessation itself, or you stop halfway, it doesn't matter, it should be enough to show you that that which knows, call it the chitta if you like, or consciousness, or vijnana, that can go, that can disappear, that can end. That's where you see that the mind is anatta. That's how you can see that it can cease. That's where you know that nibbana is not some refined consciousness, but is the ending of consciousness. That's where you can understand Talaputatera's saying that there consciousness will be destroyed. The mind will perish. It's hard for people to understand if you haven't attained those states. But this is the degree of anatta, the degree of non-self. It's not just most things are anatta, just all things are anatta. Sabbe dhamma anatta. Even nibbana anatta. That's why nibbana disappears, ends, parinibbanas. Even nibbana nibbanas. And when one understands this, one understands the depths of anatta. And for the rest of the time you're in this world, you understand that this is just the play of samsara. The process just keep going on. Soon will be ended. You understand about anatta. You understand why it is people suffer in the world. You understand why this attachment is the seminary which I gave many years ago. The attachment is not because of things out there. It's because of the illusion inside of you. As long as that illusion that you are is there, you'll always be craving, you'll always be attaching to something. Like a hand, that's what a hand does, pick things up. That's what the illusion of self does, picks things up. And things are heavy with suffering. And so hard to put down again once you pick them up. Cut off that hand. Cut off that illusion. The Buddha's teachings are so perfect, so profound, so deep. You've heard those teachings, you know those teachings. You haven't seen those teachings yet. Practice those teachings all the way into the jhanas. Practice letting go. See the end of suffering. Or see suffering ending bit by bit as you go more and more into bliss. And there you'll see for yourself what the Buddha saw. Remember, the Buddha became enlightened by going through the jhanas. As did all arahats, male and female. This is stages of letting go. Letting go of the self. Letting go of will, letting go of consciousness. It's a training in this. It's letting go of suffering as well. Don't think that the retreat has ended. Retreat will always keep going on, whether you're here or somewhere else in the world. The retreat will only end when suffering ends. Keeping that in mind, know the path and see how much of the path that you can manifest. Always have that confidence and faith that you are never that far from Nibbana. Sometimes it's like walking north and south, south and north, north and south, south and north, along a fence line, never passing through. We spend all our life walking north and south, just going the opposite direction, east or west. Just that little change of direction, that's all it takes. And then things start to happen. It's called letting go. Remember the story of Venerable Ananda, which I've been telling a few people at the end of this period we call the Rains Retreat. He's about to go to this big meeting with 499 arahats, and he was still Putujana. Sorry, still a stream winner. Still Seka. He'd meditated all night, but getting nowhere. And then he went to lay down. All that effort which he put in finally paid off when he let go. When he gave up trying, when he stopped doing, and not only did he become an arahat in those few moments, but gained all those beautiful psychic powers as well, just through letting go. Remember those beautiful words, wherever you go in the world, whatever monastery you're in, the path to Nibbana is called letting go. But do it properly so you know what those words really mean. Let go of the sense of self. Let go of the doer. Let go of the knower. And allow those two things to fade and cease. So that's the talk this evening on anatta, letting go, and ending things.